The Transportation Committee will come to order. Today we have several overviews from different departments, and first up is the Department of Public Safety.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. With me is Jared Jordahl, Director of our Government Relations Division. Thank you for the opportunity to present our budget. I understand you're kind of pressed for time, so we will do our overview. Our plan is to do a brief, I will do a brief overview of each one of our divisions funded under the Transportation Division. And then after I've done the overview, I'll ask each respective division director to come up and join us in case there are any questions about programs.
Okay, great. Thank you, Commissioner.
The DPS mission is to protect citizens and communities, prevent, prepare, respond, recover, educate, and enforce. Focus on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services, and maintain the public trust and developing strong partnerships. The 2010-11 Governor's budget recommendations are divided as follows. The total of all funding requests is $615,244,000. Of that, 3% is from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, 29% or $182,542,000 is from the General Fund, $175,568,000 or 29% is from Trunk Highway. State government special revenue totals $121,988,000 or 20%. And miscellaneous special revenue is $115,882,000 or 19%. Expenses by category, 11% of the money is transferred to other units of government, other divisions. Or departments, rather. Payments to individuals equals 1% or $3,798,000. Compensation is 47% of our budget or $288,075,000. Other operating costs total $162,893,000 or 26%. And local assistance is $95,082,000 or 15%.
And Commissioner, maybe you can just talk briefly about what the 1% payment to the individuals.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear the last part of the question. 1% payment to individuals.
Where? Is that the best reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to ask Frank Cairns to join me in case I'm misspeaking here, but I think it's the bulletproof vest reimbursement program that we have for law enforcement officers. And also the insurance reimbursement to local units of government for police and firefighters that are injured in the line of duty.
Okay, thank you.
The 2010-11 direct appropriations budget is a 1% increase, which represents the forecast base and then budget change items that I'll go over in just a minute. The DWI laboratory testing program is one budget change item that we have. Traditionally, before fiscal year 02-03, prior to the 02-03 biennium, the program for the 200 law enforcement intoxilizers that we operate out of the BCA, that program was funded out of the Trunk Highway Fund. It was moved to the General Fund, and the governor's recommendation is to move it back to the Trunk Highway Fund. That would be a $1.57 million per year change.
And Commissioner, just so that there's no surprises, that's not going to be part of our recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we worked long and hard to try to clean up the Trunk Highway Fund, you know, to keep the bleeding from occurring on the Trunk Highway Fund, and that's why we moved all that back and went to a, for Ms. McCormick and their group, went back to a fee-based system so that it pays for itself and there's not money being used out of the Trunk Highway Fund for those purposes. But that's one point that you won't see that in our document.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I understand I'm not trying to be argumentative, but our justification and the governor's justification was to relieve some stress on the general fund, and also that 20% of all the DWI arrests come from the state patrol as a result of their work, and they're funded constitutionally through the, and it's constitutionally permitted through the Trunk Highway Fund, and that it would be a natural fit.
Mm-hmm.
the public safety divisions by legislative committee. We have in the public safety area, not heard in this particular division, we have Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Office of Justice Programs, Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Emergency Communication Networks, and the State Fire Marshal's Office. Under the transportation divisions, we have the Minnesota State Patrol, Driver and Vehicle Services, Office of Traffic Safety, Administration and Related Services, and the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is in the Fire Marshal's office. Those are the divisions that we'll be going over today. First of all, the Minnesota State Patrol. Their mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. Their annual operating budget of $82,406,000 for fiscal year 2009, and they have a staff currently of 954 full-time equivalent positions. For the 2010-2011 biennium, $158,328,000 of their funding comes from the Trunk Highway Fund, $184,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and $6.3 million from the General Fund. The various services within the State Patrol include aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, drug recognition experts, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, the training academy, radio communications, and a special response team. With that, I'll have Colonel Donaski come up in case there are any specific questions about the State Patrol services.
Well, thank you. And Colonel, thanks for joining us. Chief, maybe you can... Here's the question I have, and this is in regards to, you know, we're trying to put together data, and Ms. Marty and a lot of folks have been very good about getting data together for seatbelts and things like that. I'm trying to do a better job of quantifying what it actually costs when we lose lives on Minnesota roads or when there are serious crashes that have medical costs related to that, and we're getting that from other folks. But what I'd like to know from you is, you know, on top of the cost of accident reconstruction and, you know, just the State Patrol's overall effort at the scene of a crash, you know, maybe if you can quantify, and you don't have to give me an answer now, but quantify what the total costs of crashes are to the State Patrol.
Mr. Chair, and for the record, I'm Mark Donaski, representing the Minnesota State Patrol. Mr. Chair, if I'm hearing what you're asking me to do, and we can certainly do that, is to go back and recapture the number of crashes we attend annually and kind of estimate the amount of time that's spent on those from the State Patrol's position. Would that be accurate?
Right, and what that time relates to in terms of actual dollars.
Yes, sir, I think I can do that.
Okay, great. Well, I appreciate it, Chief, because, you know, this getting the primary enforcement on the seatbelt is, I think, paramount. That's all I had, Chief. If Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, Chief, what I was wondering is how many State Patrol people do we have now? And what is our allotment, and where are we as far as full, I don't know what the correct word is, but full allotment of however many officers you could have?
Chief.
Mr. Chair, Senator Day, it's a good question that's often asked. The Minnesota State Patrol doesn't have an allotment or a contingent as such. What we do is we carry as many full-time equivalents or officers as our budget allows us to carry. And so consequently, as we move into a biennium, we look to the biennium to what those costs are going to be, and then we determine how many officers we can carry with that number. To your first question, sir, we're at about 535 sworn officers that we have going on right now. We do have an academy that's in progress right now that will be graduating later on in April, and when that academy comes out, we will be at approximately 585, I believe, is where we'll be with that number.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Senator.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, I was concerned when I think it was you before this committee talked about, like, in December and maybe it was just November, December, like 18 squads had been rear-ended or destroyed and well, people hitting them. And the number of people hitting them that didn't have insurance. And number one, there's some bills floating around that are going after inattentive driving and those kinds of things. But we just had a deputy up in one of my counties that was at an accident scene and somebody plowed into him and, you know, tremendous injuries. And I just think we need to try to tighten that up some more. But I'm very concerned that we can't figure out some kind of mechanism to go after these people. I mean, especially taking out a squad car and not having insurance. And I don't know what the answer is, but I want you to know that I'm very concerned that that's happening, and I'd like to work on some fixes on that.
Mr. Chair. Chief. Senator Olsen, thank you very much. We do, in those cases where the squad car is struck, and I believe in checking with our fleet manager, since the beginning of December, we've had approximately 50 cruisers hit. In those cases where the vehicle loses control and strikes a squad car, we do issue a citation for inattentive driving or whatever charge we would have. And if the individual does not indicates or proves that there is not insurance, we do issue a citation for non-insurance as well. In many cases in the non-insurance area, we will try to recover costs through civil action by taking them literally to small claims court. Unfortunately, in most cases, those individuals that don't have the money to pay for insurance generally don't have the means to cover what a small claims would take up either. So, in essence, the citizens of the state end up paying for those damages. But we are doing whatever we can to try and recover those costs as best we can.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, I think I heard you right. You said 50 cruisers have been hit?
I believe, sir, the last time I checked my fleet, the individual, since the beginning of December, we've had approximately 50 cars involved in crashes, correct?
And, Mr. Chair, Colonel, do you have a breakdown of how many of those were your traditionally marked vehicles versus the unmarked or the less marked or whatever they are?
I don't have that with me, sir, but I will tell you that, Mr. Chair, this year in particular, we had, compared to recent winters, we did have a very difficult winter. We had a lot of vehicles off the road. We had a lot of crashes were out there. I will tell you that the vast majority of these squad cars were marked squad cars with their lights on just sitting alongside the road.
Thank you.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I just, and Chief, I don't know what more that we can do. We've passed the move over as far to the left as you can. I just don't know what more can be done other than having a, I don't know, a hand jump out of the steering wheel and slap somebody awake. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the legislators' concern over the troopers and all the law enforcement in the state. It's a cultural issue, and keep in mind that the laws out there and a lot of people understand it. Unfortunately, they're not thinking far enough down the road. And so what happens is they may see the lights up ahead, and they continue to travel at that speed that they shouldn't. And as they get close enough, they realize that, oh, my gosh, there's a law that says that I've either got to pull over or I've got to slow down. At that point, they try to maneuver the vehicle or they touch the brakes, they lose control, and they come sailing into the squad car. So it's a continual education process that we have to tell people that even when they first recognize that there's an incident on the highway, and please keep in mind that this also encompasses tow truck drivers that are working alongside the road or ambulance personnel, anybody where that's the work zone that's out there. Whenever people see that there's a hazard up ahead, they have to start consciously thinking about what am I going to do as I proceed forward and as I pass the scene so we keep those individuals safe on the roadway. We continue to try to educate both through the traditional advertising and also through our roadside education process.
Thank you. Roadside education process. I like how you put that, Colonel.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, I'm pretty excited about the Office of People Transportation Safety, and if you could just give us an update about how it's going, if you're getting the funding going, and all of that kind of stuff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, yes, sir. Thank you, and thank you very much for your support on this very important topic. As you're well aware, we have put Lieutenant Edward Carroll, who's the pupil transportation head, on that now. He's working, and as you know, we put forth our proposal for how we're going to structure that program. On July 1st, when that funding comes through, we will then put the three state trooper inspectors in position for that, as well as deploying the commercial vehicle inspectors to start those processes, to taking a harder look at the drivers involved, not only what we've done traditionally in the past, the once-a-year inspections, but now starting to look at more of the driver and driver behavioral issues that traditionally, as we go back and look at our crashes, are caused by behavior, not necessarily by the vehicle itself.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Colonel, I'm still in shock a little bit about that 50 accidents. Can you give me a feel for instance, the total damage that entailed? And let's say if we were trying to cut that in half, what would we have to work with? What's the dollar figure?
Mr. Chair, Senator, and please keep that in mind. When we say 50, I think that people right away tend to think about a car completely demolished. Of those 50, as a matter of fact, last time I testified before this body or in the House, I think I mentioned that roughly a third of those ended up in being total losses. And the totality of the loss is determined upon whether or not the car was actually totally damaged, or if the car was old enough that we just decided that it wasn't worthwhile putting the amount of money back into the car that we could recover from salvaging it. So it goes all the way from somebody just sliding along and skidding up against the side of a fender to a semi-truck coming down the highway and completely, totally obliterating one of the squad cars. As far as the total numeric number as to what those costs are, I don't have them with me, but I'd be more than happy to present them to you at some time. I do know that it is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Chief. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Moving on to the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. The mission of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division is to be committed to providing fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and business partners. DVS has an annual budget of approximately $55.6 million, with 534 employees working in 98 locations throughout the state. DVS raises approximately $1 billion in state revenue annually, and DVS is funded by the Special Revenue Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. DVS services include title and registration, auto dealer licensing and inspection, prorate, driver exams, driver compliance, driver's license issuing, public information center, operations support, and e-business. We have Ms. McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, here at the table in case there are any specific questions about her operation.
Well, thanks for coming over, Ms. McCormick. My question is in regards to our new computer system, and if you can just give us 1 minute on how we're coming with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, and as we had stated, I think, in our last meeting, that we were building cash at this time for the project, and we're right on target with about approximately $1 million a month, so we have a little over $8 million that for the project. We have a project team that has been appointed or put in place that is working on a definite project plan, and within that project plan, it includes the approach that we're taking, how we will look at procurement issues, contract issues. We're starting to hire some of the technical staff that we need to begin that project, and we're working with Department of Administration on the correct procurement processes to get into place. So that's kind of a basic. In addition to that, I should state that on the business side, we have two technical projects that we're working on that we feel are good learning tools for what we need. The one I've talked about before, that's the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act implementation that we have to do. As you know, we met structured testing, which was a requirement of the federal government, so we would not be sanctioned by the feds for highway funds. but now we have to implement it. And so that requires a great deal of data cleanup, and we have technical staff that are working on that along with our business staff. And I think it's a good learning process to how we go about doing data cleanup, because when we've talked to other states about their projects, that's one of the major issues that they find. They need a lot of time for data cleanup, and so we're getting started on that process. And then we are also putting in place the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System. We are doing it on our old system, but we do believe that those same the same issues related to data cleanup and those issues are still very helpful to us as we move to the new system. We need to be in compliance by January 1st of 2010, and our date for implementation as of now is November 3rd of 2009. So we have a couple extra months if we need them, but we have our staff working hard on both of those projects, and obviously that there's a lot of tie-ins with our new project that we're working on as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, I mentioned to you a little bit earlier, I'm just curious how we're moving along with Visa. Are they on the negotiations for taking credit cards? Are they moving forward, or are they kind of dug in on the on that?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, we had sent a letter and asked that they allow Minnesota to serve as a pilot with Visa, and they turned us down. And so they will not allow us to add the convenience fee to the transaction. So our recommendation to the committee at that point in time was that we move ahead with the credit card companies that will allow us to add that, which would be Discover and MasterCard. And those two credit card companies are allowing a convenience fee to be added to the vehicle and driver license transactions if it's a face-to-face service. If it's done on the internet, as we have the registration renewal process, that is the only way that Visa does allow you to, and we go through that through our state bank contract on our online website.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. McCormick, you may, we did take add an amendment to our local mandates relief bill yesterday afternoon. I'm not sure if you are aware of that, that with regard to deputy registrars, to allow them on the face-to-face transactions to accept credit cards and apply a surcharge to that. That bill will be going to the Committee on Finance next, but I'd appreciate it if you could take a look at that amendment just to make sure the language it doesn't give anybody heartburn. Okay.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ress, we appreciate your letting us know about that. I think one of our concerns is that we want to make sure that if we do that, that we have a uniform process that all deputy registrars are following so that we don't have one deputy giving one price and another deputy giving another price. And when we had our credit card working group, we were working with management and budget on the fact that we think we may be able to work within our current contract that the state has. So we would look at it, and we'll ask management and budget to look at it as well.
And, Mr. Chairman, I thought someone speaking about it and about that amendment also had indicated that American Express was favorable. But that's not the case. It's just MasterCard and Discover.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, American Express may be as well. The one concern that we just need to check out is we have to make sure that the sweeping of the accounts and the way they balance the accounts meets the state's deadlines, and that's the major concern, so that the cash is flowing within the state and within the time frame that it needs to. So we can check on that.
Thank you very much. That will be a huge convenience for customers at deputy registrars, and particularly for those municipalities that have a deputy registrar right there in the city hall, that means a lot to increase that convenience. So appreciate it if you take a look at it.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, in the case of visas restrictions, are you able to just increase your fees and then it would be up to the department to allocate that accordingly?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, we did look at that, but that would be we would need to increase our fees to the point where we would have to raise several million dollars, and we did not feel that that was something that was workable, not only in today's economy, but I think in terms of Minnesotans in general like to have those options. We have a mail-in option for registration renewal, which we have about 23% of Minnesotans use, so they don't have to pay additional costs like the tab renewal, and then on our website. And then we have the face-to-face where they participate and go to deputy registrars, and we have over 73% of our customers do use deputy registrar services. So,
Mr. Chair, Ms. McCormick, I can appreciate that, so that you want it to be fair, that people who don't use that convenience aren't paying an additional fee. And perhaps if you end up offering a service to American Express, Discover, and MasterCard users, that will send a strong signal to Visa that, you know, and if more and more states do that, that they're missing out and maybe will change their behavior.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, we would like that to be the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick.
Office of Traffic Safety is the next division. Their vision is to reduce fatalities and serious injuries to zero on Minnesota roads. Their mission is to create a culture where traffic fatalities are no longer acceptable through the integrated application of education, engineering, enforcement, and emergency trauma services. These efforts will be driven by data, best practices, and research. Office of Traffic Safety receives an annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund of $435,000. And that is a required match, which allows the office to secure federal funds, grants, and one-time monies that annually amount to approximately $28 million. Office of Traffic Safety services include traffic safety outreach, impaired driving prevention, occupant protection, child passenger safety, traffic records data systems, safe community coalitions, motorcycle safety program, a teen driving safety program, underage alcohol prevention, traffic safety research and analysis, and crash outcome and data evaluation, and also a fatal analysis record system. Ms. Marty is with me. She's the director of the Office of Traffic Safety in case people have specific questions.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Marty, earlier you were showing me the updated versions of the talking points on the primary seatbelt. Maybe you can relay with the committee those the two disturbing things that you showed me were the rates in Greater Minnesota, and in Greater Minnesota not only the unbelted but also the alcohol related.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we were just providing Mr. Chair the updated fact sheets on our seatbelt use in our state and some of the disturbing facts of those that are unbelted. And a couple of the points that I pointed out, that when we look at hospital charges and hospital costs, in 1 year alone, we would have 1,900 Minnesotans that were in an unbelted traffic crash, received hospital care. Those individuals would not have had to go into the hospital at all had they worn their seatbelt. So that was a disturbing fact, that 1,900 Minnesotans in 1 year alone would not receive hospital care had they worn their seatbelt. Also, we were also taking a look at those that were involved in alcohol-related crashes. Of those alcohol-related fatalities, 80% were not buckled up. in the rural communities,
80%
of the rural fatalities were unbuckled fatalities. So those were a few of the key points that I had highlighted earlier.
Yeah. What Ms. Marty is saying is that, you know, not only are 80% of the fatalities unbelted in greater Minnesota, but that's where the majority of fatalities happen overall. And I think that we've got a pretty good understanding that, and I think that we have rock-solid evidence that shows that in greater Minnesota, you know, there's some driving behaviors out on the road that need to change.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Senator Jungbauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to whoever can answer this, we talk about trying to create zero fatalities, but we're talking about best practices and research. I'm kind of wondering how old is the best practices and research. I just had a deal going on with pollution control where they wrote me a nasty letter about using best management practices, and it just so happens that their best management practices are 20 years outdated already, so I'm kind of hoping that maybe this agency has something more updated than the pollution control agency might use.
Ms. Marty?
We do share best practices among the states. Minnesota is one of all states that have members of the Governor's Highway Safety Association. So we have our annual meeting. We also have regional meetings with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And part of our role is to share practices that we feel are effective within our states in all of the areas that Commissioner Ellison had covered earlier, older drivers, teens, and so forth. So we are looking at what is on our current environment and the current risky driver behaviors. What is it that's out there that seems to be working? We do want to base that on evaluation data. So, for example, one of the best practices that we know that's working in Minnesota is that we're working in partnership with MnDOT and also law enforcement, the State Patrol, and we're looking at speed limits. And we're looking at corridors that we could possibly safely increase speed limits so that would satisfy the community if it was safe, but also in addition to increasing that speed limit, we would add added enforcement. And we advertise that, we communicate that broadly, and that's part of our speed management program. So we do try to stay very current, and we were working with the university on that program as well, and they were part of the evaluation to see over the long term, after we've increased those speed limits and we've added enforcement, are people staying, are they driving the speed limit? And the answer is yes. We're having some success with that program. There are lots of examples I could give, but it is important that we stay current in our practices.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again to whoever might be able to answer this. When we're talking about the seatbelt use and stuff, Senator Langseth and I were just talking that statistically Minnesota, I think it was like 84% compliance with seatbelt use, and yet when you're talking 80% of these alcohol-related not using seatbelts, are we sliding on our overall compliance, or is this just under certain circumstances? Are the numbers changing in Minnesota?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our seatbelt use rate, as we've last identified last fall, our last survey was in August of 2008, and that is our current rate is 87%. It is 87%, but we do know that there are certain behaviors that increase greater risk. So that's not 87% for all drivers. That's only 87% for front seat passengers. We know there are fewer individuals that are unbuckling in the back seat. We know that fewer rural drivers and passengers are buckling up, particularly in pickup trucks. We also know that drivers that are 30 years old and younger are less likely to buckle up. So that 87% doesn't apply to all groups and in all areas of the state.
Thank you.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Marty, in Isani County, Judge Dean has started the Safe and Sober Cab program that he's had tremendous results in reducing DWI arrests in the county, and yet we can't find a funding stream for it. You know, and I suspect this is not a good year for funding streams. But are you aware of the program, and are you aware of any federal money that might be able to help something like that? Or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, we are very supportive of the work that's happening in Isani County. We are working with the Center for Excellence in Rural Safety at the university and wanting to expand the Sober Camp program. There is, in fact, federal money through my office to help support expanding the Sober Camp program. And I have talked with Judge Dean and his colleagues in Isani County, and we are prepared to create an implementation guide to help other counties replicate what has worked. But we want to look at other models around the country as well. Again, going back to the best practices model to say what else is working, Isanti County being one model, but how can we guide other counties in implementing a similar program? And we're prepared to implement that.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Marty.
Thank you.
Administration and related services includes the Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, our Human Resources Division, Fiscal and Administrative Services, and the Office of Technical Support Services. Then finally, we have the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is located within the State Fire Marshal's Office. Their mission is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. Their budget is $2.25 million per year in special revenue and federal funds. $1.3 million per year is a direct appropriation. It's a special revenue derived from inspection fees and excavation damage prevention penalties. The Office of Pipeline Safety does pipeline inspections, oversees major pipeline projects, pipeline incident investigations. They do enforcement, and they do damage prevention. And we have the Fire Marshal, Jerry Rosendahl, here to answer any specific questions that you might have.
Questions for the committee? Chief, you're getting off easy.
Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation, unless people have further questions.
Any more questions for the commissioner? Well, I don't see any, commissioner, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for your support and for your time this afternoon. We appreciate it.
Thank you, and thanks for the overview. And next time, Mr. Jordahl gets put on the hot seat.
Sounds
good enough.
Thank you, Commissioner. And thanks to all the folks that came to provide testimony on behalf of the department.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's a pleasure to be back with you again today and provide you with an update on our proposed transit budget for fiscal years 10 and 11, and we will also provide a bit of information for 12 and 13 as well. Mr. Chair, I could go through my presentation and entertain questions throughout or after it. Doesn't matter to me. Either way you would like to proceed is fine. This is an overview. The first slide just presents an overview, kind of a composite summary of some of the transit pressures that we are experiencing at the Met Council. Demand for bus and rail transitway expansion. I consider that a mixed, though mostly positive, blessing that people like and continue to want to use our system, but of course that does present pressure. Closely related to that is increased ridership and park and ride usage. As you are aware, Mr. Chair, in calendar year 08, we provided 82 million rides. which was a 25-year high. In addition to that, Mr. Chair, we, when I came to the council, we had approximately 15,000 park and ride slots. We now have about 24,000 park and ride slots. Another area of pressure is the fluctuation in fuel prices. All of you that drive know that they fluctuate a great deal. They're a little bit down now, but of course they were quite higher. And in the recent past, it's anyone's guess what they will be a year, 2 years, 3 years out. Operations and capital funding and balances. Mr. Chair, I've spoken at some depth regarding this issue. Quite candidly, the structure that exists in this state for a capital expansion of our transit system as a result of the passage last year of the transportation bill and the quarter cent sales tax, which provides about $85 million for transit capital, puts that area of our transit system on a firmer footing than transit operations, which are disproportionately funded out of the motor vehicle sales tax. And all one has to do is look at what has happened with GM and Chrysler and Ford and their prospects. We were selling at one time in this country about 17 million cars on an annual basis. We're now down to around 9 million cars. And that just has taken a huge toll on our resources. Expansion or expiration of one-time funds. One of the things, Mr. Chair, I want to stress is that most of the solutions I'll be presenting to you today are one-time solutions to what has really, I think, can only be described as a structural problem. CTIB, the County Transit Improvement Board that was set up to dispense the $85 million of sales tax receipts, as you know, are giving us $30 million in this fiscal year, those monies go away. And CMAQ is a federal source of funding that we were using for our Hiawatha operations. The time that the FTA allowed us to use that has expired, so those are going away. And, Mr. Chair, some of the other holes that we will be filling will be the use of one-time funds as well as the stimulus dollars, and those are going to go away. So we're using a bit of spit and glue and bubble gum and string holding this together because it is, Mr. Chair, a structural problem we have, and we are using one-time fixes. This is from the pre-November forecast. State fiscal year 10 and 11, we were projecting a deficit of $37.7 million. That deficit is comprised of a rail component of $19.3 million, and you can see there are two subcomponents to that, 5.2 for Hiawatha as a result of those CMAQ funds no longer available. Those are pass-through dollars that come to us from the FTA. And $14.1 million for the biennial operating deficit for North Star. CTIB incidentally picks up the other 50% of that. So CTIB's share of Hiawatha is $5.2 million, and for North Star is $14.1 million. On the bus side of the equation, our deficit results from $5.5 million to maintain our current services. And Mr. Chair, I want to stress to this committee that maintaining current bus service is the backbone of our system where most of our customers use. And $2.9 million for some committed expansion, and that would be for Cedar Avenue, 35W, and the like. What you see here is the change from the November forecast to the February forecast. We were down $11 million in the February forecast, $23 million in the November forecast, $23 million for fiscal year 10 and 11. In November, we were projecting our deficit to be $60 million. And, Mr. Chair, in the November forecast, we were looking at $10 million for fiscal year 12 and 13. The bad news is that the February forecast has changed that mostly for the negative, though for fiscal year 09 we were up a million, so we're at 10 million there. Fiscal year 10 and 11 we're at 41 million, and for 12 and 13, Mr. Chair, we're at $40 million. This slide is a very busy but instructive slide, Mr. Chair, and what this slide really tells you is what the MVEST forecasts were and what the actual MVEST results are. And so for purposes of illustration, I'd point you to calendar year 08. You can see we got 24% of MVEST in 08. We project that we're going to be in calendar year 08 getting about $115 million of MVEST. But if you go up to the dotted lines, you will see in the November forecast of 05, it was projected to be at $107 million. In the November forecast of $170 million. In the November forecast of 04, it was projected to be $180 million. You can see by what the projections were, by the dotted lines, are much higher than what the actual performance has been represented by the solid line. That's the takeaway from that very busy chart, Mr. Chair, is that the dotted lines show projected much better performance than the solid line, which is much lower.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I know Chair Bell just emphasized and reemphasized, but I want to reemphasize the point he just made. As we migrate over the coming 5 years to 100% MVEST dedication to transportation purposes, transit is taking in literally fewer dollars. With a higher percentage of MVEST, that's how dramatic car sales are off. It's pretty staggering.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Bell? Chair Bell, thank you. Sorry, all of a sudden I couldn't remember.
We're good enough friends. You can call me Peter. So
thank you. But I hope that we've adjusted our forecasting practice because that is a concern to me when I see continuing gaps between forecast and reality year after year. It says to me that we ought to rethink the way we forecast.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, quite candidly, this is a source of some frustration for me. We have not been able to get the forecasters to put more time and energy and focus to getting more accurate forecasts. Quite candidly, Mr. Chair and Senator Bodarf, I offered to underwrite the cost from Met Council dollars to do a forecast ourselves because we keep running into trouble with that. I think somewhat legitimately there was resistance to that because then maybe other state agencies would ask to do the same. But quite candidly, we are so dependent upon MVEST, MnDOT much less so. When you look at the percentage of revenues MnDOT gets, it's not quite a rounding error, but they're not nearly as hurt by faulty forecasts as we are. And that has been a problem for us. Now, I would remind you, finally, that we only budget at 95% of forecast, and thank goodness for that. But we still have had huge dislocation resulting from faulty forecasts.
And Mr. Chair, sorry, Chair Bell, it seems to me that if we trended the percentage of forecast being off compared to real numbers, then perhaps the budgeting process ought to reflect the actual trending of being off.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, I think that that's a good suggestion. We have attempted to deal with this principally by the reserve that we have. I suspect, however, though, I don't know how much lower we can go nationally than 9 million car sales. And at some point, it is apt to pick up, and there will be a rebound. But we have had, I believe it is 10 consecutive forecasts that have been off. And the margin of error is significant.
That's crazy.
It is a problem for us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, and thank you, Senator Bonoff. I share your frustration, Chair Bell's frustration. I know they've tried to work on it, and I've tried to work on it. I've tried to communicate with the forecasters. They have, frankly, not responded to me, and I'm not happy about it. So I would encourage others to help express this issue. But the fact of the matter remains that Chair Bell is right. MBEST is not the reliable and robust and growing source that maybe it had been envisioned back in 2001 when we took the operating levy off the metro-wide sales tax. Not that I'm necessarily advocating going back to that as a matter of permanent policy, but maybe I am. I don't know. But that was the idea back then. Was we'll take this off the property tax in the metro area. We'll go to the MVEST, and it'll be this wonderful source for to grow forevermore. And look at and we find ourselves in this circumstance.
And Mr. Chair, to underscore that point is the next slide. I have used this term with this committee a number of times. We are getting an ever larger slice of an ever shrinking pie. To illustrate the point, in a fiscal year 04, we were getting 21.5% of MVEST, and that was bringing in $127 million. In fiscal year 08, we received 24% of MVEST and $116 million. So the percentage of MVEST we're getting is growing, but the dollars that we are capturing are shrinking, and this is a challenge for us. Other budget adjustments, unallotment, we had to contribute $600,000 from our general fund appropriation. Fuel price reductions, as I mentioned starting off, that they have gone up and down. We now estimate that for fiscal year 10 and 11, they will be down from our projections by $11.5 million, and inflation reduction we anticipate will also be down by $3.5 million. The bottom line, Mr. Chair, is we are projecting the fiscal year 10 and 11 deficit as a result of the February forecast to be $62.4 million. Very quickly, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
just a little clarification on your fuel price reduction. Do you have a strategy for trying to deal with this fluctuating market, and how are you smoothing out those numbers so you can get to this number that you've got?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, we do. We were given statutory authority a number of years ago to hedge our fuel prices. And we do hedge our fuel prices. As we don't do it to play the commodities market or really to make money. We do it to even out the fluctuations when fuel prices are high versus when fuel prices are low. And even when you take into consideration the hedging strategy we do, we still felt that fuel prices and really oil prices have collapsed so much from the, I think, the $147 a barrel at their peak to approximately the $48 a barrel that they're at now, that we were able to affect this reduction in our projections. But we do hedge. We don't hedge our whole book of business, but we hedge part of it.
Did you get caught, Mr. Chair, Chairman Bell, did you get caught in the high prices buying fuel at a higher cost than what they currently are?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, that's a great question. We did pay, first, we're on the plus side of it because we started off when fuel prices were, when we first started our hedging strategy. This was the question I said, our first bet has to be right. And so we started off when it was low and hedged. Fuel prices went up, and so we were made a fair amount of money. And so the hedging we did, and I can't give you the exact numbers, when fuel prices were higher, I don't think we hedged at 147, but when fuel prices were a little higher, they have come down now, and we've paid a slight penalty for that. When you even it all out and look at what's the net impact on the Met Council, we are net ahead as a result of our hedging. That might not be the case forever, though, because hedging is just what it seems, and it is really to provide us more balance and a smoother projection for our fuel prices than anything else.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, what you're saying is that you got over on the fuel company?
Initially.
Well, at least there's somebody here.
Yes, that's a rare thing, but initially we did, Mr. Chair. On the next slide is really the source of our imbalance for fiscal year 10 and 11, or excuse me, for the various years. You can see for fiscal year 09, the 9.7 is bus. For fiscal year 10, the 38.9 is primarily bus with a small amount of rail. For fiscal year 11, it's close, 13.8 for bus, 9.7 for rail. And, Mr. Chair, I won't go through the rest, but you can see the relationship for fiscal year 12 and 13. To the more important question of our response, for fiscal year 9, as I've shared with this committee, our deficit is about $9.7 million, and our strategy for addressing this is MVEST reduction for some of the suburban transit providers. As you know, Mr. Chair, we provide funding for the suburban transit providers who rely on MVEST, so that will be $1.8 million. Drawdown of council reserves, this is something that we have to do very cautiously, and I'm very sensitive to. But I think if this fiscal environment is not a time to use reserves, I'm not sure which one would be. We're looking at $7.15 million and other efficiencies about $750,000, which allows us to balance our books at the end of this fiscal year. For 10 and 11, as I mentioned earlier, our deficit is 62.4. Our strategies are multiple strategies. And as I mentioned 5 or 10 minutes ago, these are structural problems as I see them, and we are using one-time solutions. The Livable Communities grant program, as I've stated before to this committee, is not fully subscribed to. We will be asking for statutory authority to use 50% of those dollars to cover our operating deficit. Our TIBRA program, tax-based revitalization, is to clean up polluted lands. We will be using 50% of that. And the RALF fund, which is to buy road right-of-way, all of these funds, we will be taking 50% of them. Bottom line is we'll be keeping our levy flat, but we will be redeploying the use of those funds subject to legislative permission. The second is the stimulus package, $14 million over the biennium we will be using for one-time funds. These are commonly referred to as 5307 dollars, and we will be using those for our operating, primarily to cover our operating costs. Next slide, please.
Mr. Bell, I had one question on the next slide back, Mr. Shetman. You say you're going to use $7.15 million and draw down some reserves. Your reserves your reserve right now is someplace between about $15 and $20 million.
That's correct.
And so after we get done with this exercise, it's going to be around 8 or 10, right around there?
That's correct.
I understand why you're nervous about that then. Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I really think we're at the low water mark here, because I always say my crystal ball is permanently cloudy. I read, as everyone else does, the economic forecast for the next couple of years. I don't have a clue what awaits us in the out years. The Met Council response administrative interventions for fiscal year 10 and 11, service efficiencies, we're looking at about $5 million, $3 million. This is a different pot of reserves. It gets somewhat complicated, but this is reserves that we have for our bonding capacity. We're going to use $3 million of that. MVEST reduction to other regional providers of about $7 million. We're looking at a fare increase in July 2010 of $6 million and additional service reductions if necessary. When you add that up, Mr. Chair, that is how we intend to deal with the 10 and 11 budget deficit of $62 million. Next slide. I think it is only fair to point out risks.
Excuse me, Mr.
I'm
Chair.
Sorry.
Chair Bell.
Senator Bonoff.
In terms of the lessening the MVEST to the regional providers, can you do that unilaterally, or is there an agreement?
Chair Senator Bonner, if there is a formula that we have for the suburban transit providers and the use of MVEST hours.
Mr. Bell, Senator Sieben has a question here as well, but we haven't, you talked earlier about the TIBRA and the right-of-way and livable communities, and you're going to draw down some of those funds. We haven't seen any legislation in that regard. If you could swing it our way, we'll see what we can do about helping you out.
Mr. Chair, I believe Senator Rest is going to be introducing that legislation. I think it's tomorrow.
Okay. All right, great. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Bell, I'm not real familiar with your levy or how it works, but if there was support from the administration to increase your levy, could you increase your levy to reduce some of the, for instance, the fare increase or some of the other revenue sources you're looking at? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, the answer to that is yes. We levy about $70 million on an annual basis. We use that levy for a wide array of things to cover our administrative costs. We use it for the livable communities grant program. We use it for a number of different things. We have actually increased the levy since I have been chair about 1% a year, which really just accommodates population growth. Basically, it's been flat. However, the mix within that $70 million is different. We've increased the levy for transit within that flat levy about 3% a year. And if there was support, we could increase the levy. Yes, Senator Sieben.
But that's not part of your proposal at this
time?
No,
it is not.
Senator Double.
On a similar subject, a subset of the region that uses transit experiences a levy for transit capital purposes, despite the fact that folks from outside that transit taxing district very much use our transit system in the capital effort, the park and rides and the buses. So there's been, we've passed through the Senate a couple times, just making the transit taxing district contiguous with the metropolitan area. How much more would, if we didn't increase the levy, but at the same time didn't just simply distribute the dollar amount that we're levying, just, everyone paid the, 20, 25 bucks per year per household. Do we know how much that might raise?
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I don't have that information right at hand. I'm not sure.
If you raise it?
Mr. Chair,
Shetnan.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Shetnan, for the record.
Yep, my name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. And, Senator Dibble, were you asking the question if you were just to spread that levy out across the entire seven-county metro area? I think those folks that currently don't pay that levy would, on a $200,000 priced home, they would see their they'd see about a $25 increase in their taxes, where when you spread it across the rest of the folks who are currently paying, they would see about a $2 to $4 decrease in their overall.
I think the question is, if he didn't reduce it and just levied it.
I think Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I think that we have looked at that you would be able to squeeze out of another $2.5 million worth of
okay. All right, thanks.
Capital.
Mr. Chair, it should be. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Mr.
One other point.
They drive
currently, as it stands, a city now, and this really just simply doesn't work. A city has to raise their hand and say, we will come into the transit taxing district. And the difficulty it presents to us is that city leaders, elected officials, can't raise their hand and say, we want to come in the transit taxing district unless there is an immediate quid pro quo. And that just forces inefficient growth of our transit system. It may not make sense to immediately put transit services or a park and ride in their community. And, of course, other cities who are currently in the transit taxing district who don't have a park and ride say, well, gee whiz, how come another municipality who raises their hand can use that as leverage to get something where we're already in the transit taxing district and we don't have a certain amenity or the like. And it would force us to develop our transit system in an inefficient way. I have been on record as supporting at a minimum an expansion of the transit taxing district, either in a way that left the levy flat, so no additional money was coming in, but everyone was paying it, and it would be a decision by the elected officials and the governor whether it should be increased or not. But at a minimum, the amount we're collecting, I'd like to spread over the entire seven-county region, and I've been on record supporting that.
Senator Kelash.
Chairman Bell, I'm just kind of wondering what the percentage of when you do these reductions for the regional providers, what percentage is that of what you're currently paying? And I'm sure it's going to increase their fares, but is it going to be an increase that's going to reduce ridership on those?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, I don't have the exact figure about what increase, what impact it will have on their direct budget. They have varying levels of reserves with the suburban transit providers. Some of them, their reserves are close to 100% of what their yearly operating budget are, and others, their reserves are much more more modest than that. And I can get you the figure of what this reduction will be as a percentage of their overall budget. That's a very fair question.
I'm looking for a percentage of what you're currently paying as to what this $7 million reduction is as a cut from that. I don't know what the number is for what you're paying.
Yes.
Is that, can you give me a ballpark on that? We're talking 5%, or I don't know where it is in the what you're currently paying.
I think it's in the neighborhood of 5 or 7%.
You get 17.5% of 21.5% of MBEST, which is strange.
Yeah, they get 17.5% of 21.5% of MBEST. They were frozen at the 21.5%, and they get 17.5% of that.
It's their equitable share of the reduction.
Yes, it's a pro rata share of the reduction. It's not more than that. But it's a fair point to say that they are disproportionately dependent upon MBEST. So that's a fair observation and concern. The fiscal year 10 and 11 risks relies upon $44 million in one-time funds. This is the livable communities funds, stimulus funds, and the like. The July 2010 fare increase we anticipate will cause us approximately 3.5 million riders. That's an inexact number, but when you raise a fare a dollar, we yield, in a crude sense, about 70 cents because of the drop-off in ridership. So if you raise the fare a dollar, Mr. Chair, you don't get a full dollar. There's a market dynamic. You lose some riders, and it's crudely about 70 cents. The unreliability of MVEST, fluctuation in fuel prices, our bus reserves at levels of less than 2%. We have a number of reserves at the council. One is the bus reserve, a second is the MVEST reserve, and I talked to you about the debt servicing reserve. The bus reserve would go down to about $4 million, and you can see we have a target of over $20 million. While facing losses of $44 million in one-time funds and funding from MVEST, there's the fuel price risk as well. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll entertain any questions you may have.
Questions from the committee.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bell, I think I might have asked it before, but I want to be sure that we don't write specs for new buses so that Minnesota bus companies are excluded from being in the bidding process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I am very familiar with the concern that you have and the company that you're referring to. We are going to be on a fairly aggressive bus acquisition program in the not-too-distant future, and I want to be very clear that I think Minnesota companies will be able to participate in that.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Bell, first of all, I want to compliment you on your tie. Really, I've been looking at that going, man, that's a good-looking tie. I like that one.
I wore it for this committee.
Thank you. The second thing is I want to thank you also in the issue between the Metropolitan Council and Minnesota Valley Transit Authority and that issue with the title transfer and working with those entities to get that squared away. And we put it through on the amendment yesterday, and hopefully it'll get passed through on the House side. But I want to thank you for your work there. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bell, one question for me. What is the total operating cost for the Hiawatha line?
The total operating, you're talking about the operating deficit or the operating cost?
Well, first let's start with the cost and then the deficit.
It's $25 million annually is the operating cost.
Okay.
Is that the...
We split it with before fares, and we split it with sea fares.
Oh, this is before. Well, what's the? Yes, that's before fares.
And Mr. Chair, and Ms. Boyd, that also does not include taking, or that includes the CTIB a half as well, the operating, because they pay 50% of the operating every year. So.
All right, further questions? I don't see any. Well, thank you, Mr. Bell and Mr. Shetnan, and thanks for bringing your crew with you. I see some of them have green on.
I wore a green suit today.
Yes. I wasn't going to give you any grief about the colorful tie that – I like that tie.
I'll remember that, Mr. Chair.
And with that, I believe that all of our work here is done, and we'll see everybody on Thursday. Thank you. Oh, and on Thursday we're going to put the budget document on the table, and we'll explain it briefly and then let people take it home over the weekend and look it over, and then we'll mark it up on Tuesday. I know that is a... I'm just inviting trouble there by letting you all have a look at it for the whole weekend. But anyway, with that, the committee is adjourned. Thank you.